Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hello and welcome to Nothing Concrete, the Barbican podcast. This week, you'll find us once more exploring our interview archive, travelling back to 2012 and listening in to a conversation between Norwegian pianist Leif Ove Andsnes and John Talansky about the piano work of Beethoven.
And it's just so haunting, you know, you can't go wrong with it. It's just, there's something about those notes. You play them together and they sound totally magical, and they sound like the most beautiful melody I've ever heard, and it all comes from down somewhere, which is very, very deep.
We'll hear the pianist and conductor's thoughts on what he considers some of the most significant piano music ever written, which he brought to the ears of the audience at the venue back in 2012. Let's learn now about the pianist's approach to Beethoven's tempestuous, tuneful, beautiful and uplifting piano sonatas. Over to John Talansky.
The music of Beethoven, his first piano concerto, played by one of the most greatly acclaimed virtuoso artists of our time, Leif Ove Andsnes, accompanied by the Mahler Chamber Orchestra, and they're conducted by Leif Ove Andsnes. Yes, these set of recordings of the Beethoven concerti that are coming out are all featuring Leif Ove Andsnes playing the piano and also conducting, and if I may say so, obtaining a wonderful detail and rhythm and nuance from the orchestra. It's part of a very big international project over a long period of time that Leif Ove Andsnes has called the Beethoven Journey. And indeed, Beethoven is the composer that features right through his Barbican recital on March the 4th at 7:30, in which he's going to be playing music from Beethoven's early, middle and late periods, and a particularly interesting and rarely performed work that was written at a very critical time in his life. And so Beethoven is particularly a concentrated part of Leif Ove Andsnes's extremely wide repertoire at present. He's here for this Barbican Classical Music podcast to talk about Beethoven and, of course, about the recital on March the 4th. Leif Ove, that was a very long introduction from me, but it's nice to see you again. Thank you
very
for coming
nice to
along
see you
here. The Beethoven Journey would be an interesting starting point, if we may. Let's hear how you conceived it and where you've got with it.
Well, it's grew with me, this idea that I had to devote a period of time to this great composer. And, you know, as a pianist, you have such a privilege of so much repertoire. Actually, the main challenge is often to know how to choose and what to choose and when to choose it. And I have never devoted a period to one composer like this. I've always spread myself. Okay, I've done some projects, Schubert sonatas over some years, but I always at the same time played Rachmaninoff and Prokofiev, whatever. Now I thought, you know, I never made Beethoven the focus of my activities, and I love more and more this music, and I see how much this music is.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Well, just so human, so spiritual, so important to both me and to the audience. And I want to devote 3 or 4 years to it. Then actually, I mean, this becomes also a very long answer now. 5, 6 years ago, I played concerts in Sao Paulo in Brazil. And I stayed in a hotel where I, every time I entered the lift, heard a fragment of the first or second piano concerto by Beethoven. It was played in a loop. And I thought this would make me mad. But actually the opposite thing happened, that I thought every time I heard 37 seconds of it, you know, what a wonderful idea, how fresh, how beautiful, how true, how provoking. And I started thinking, you know, this has to happen now, this period of with me and Beethoven. Now is the time. And yeah, then I decided to do that.
Your Beethoven journey, of course, which is taking you around the world, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's geographically a journey very much, because I'm playing these concertos and sonatas on different continents. And my aim is also to play them, the concertos, with different conductors, different orchestras, and then also play without a conductor to lead the orchestra myself, which I'm then ultimately doing when I'm recording them with the Mahler Chamber Orchestra. So it's a journey in many respects, but it's also, of course, an inner journey for me to try to get closer and closer to the heart of this great music.
And when you take this journey on, it is almost, isn't it, you were talking about Beethoven being very fresh, it is almost, isn't it, like looking at a journey of the most cataclysmic change, really, in music, I think that's almost ever taken place in a short period of time because of one composer. If we look at this astonishing development and trajectory in his style and at the beginning of his life, where he was in musical perspective, historically speaking, and by the time he died, which was, what, only 30 years after he'd started composing, really, how the world of music had changed in so many ways because of him. So that's a tremendous span, isn't it, to take on?
And of course, how it influenced the future of music after him as well. So greatly, yeah. Yes, you're right. This development is enormous, and at the same time, I always think when I read things about the five piano concertos, they are written within a relative, you know, short span of time. I mean, 11, 12 years or so. But there is a development, and one always reads that the first two piano concertos are very much in the tradition of Haydn and Mozart, and then by the third, he finds himself, and there's the personality of Beethoven. I tend to disagree with that. I mean, there's so much real Beethoven in the two first piano concertos. You know, you have that new sound, both in the orchestra, that very symphonic sound, the provoking chords, you know, the space, and the a new joy in the piano virtuosity, you know, show what I can do, you know, look what I can do. I want to show you both compositionally and pianistically. This is fun. There's so much of that in the two first concertos, and the slow movements have a new space, also between the chords that you don't find in Mozart, for instance. So it's a new, it's a completely new world, you know, he was in a galaxy of his own.
That was part of the second movement of Beethoven's first piano concerto in the new recording, relatively new recording, with Lefauver Ansnes playing and also directing, conducting the Mahler Chamber Orchestra. And if I may say so, getting a really wonderful style and tension there. So this is something that I hope you will develop more and more and more as time goes on, conducting.
Well, thank you, but I don't have any ambition to conduct symphonies, though. I mean, what I find it very challenging, but also lots of fun to be directing or conducting, if you want, the chamber orchestras in these concertos. It's challenging because it is a different world from Mozart, which is so much about dialogue and listening to each other and a kind of extended chamber music. In Beethoven, you find that there is a new element of also friction between the soloist and the orchestra. You know, the soloist is taking the material and says, hey, I can do it better than you. I can do it, you know, in a different way. And the orchestra has to be also very strong. There is this new sound. So the challenge is for it not to become just another session of cozy chamber music making. the music is more ambitious than that. But it's psychologically very interesting for me then to do this double role, because I have to be very strong as a soloist and also give them impulse as a leader. And then there are moments where we melt together in great chamber music making, and then other moments where we're really separate. And I couldn't do it without, you know, the great quality of this orchestra, which is it's such an injection for me to work with them. I get so much back from these musicians.
Well, you mentioned the word challenge, but you've taken a big challenge on yourself with your recital, because it's a huge span of Beethoven's life as a composer, beginning around 1799, 1800, with the sonata in B-flat major, number 11, opus 22, going through the variations in F major, opus 34, which was around 1802, then the Appassionata Sonata, which was about 1805, and ending up with the opus 101, which was written probably around 1816. And those dates aren't really anyhow relevant, because what's relevant is the extraordinary variety and development of these works and styles. Starting off with the opus 11 in B-flat major, opus 22, and some people think of this as the end of an era, don't they? I'm not so sure I do feel about this. I mean, even the quirky opening, I always think, could only be Beethoven, couldn't it?
Yes, but it has you know, all the marks of the early style, and, you know, the joy of the virtuosity and of the gestures. You could say that, you know, it's influenced by the Haydn gestures, that quirky opening. It's a little bit also like Opus 10, number 2, F major, you know, those kind of openings. And then there's this very brilliant first movement. What marks maybe a new development is the slow movement, I think, which is so spacious. It's a sort of what do you call it? Rollicking slow adagio, which just opens up so many doors in this cantilena. It's a long aria basically, but with so much space. I can't think of any other of the early sonatas that quite has that in it. And I find it a very unique movement in the whole output by Beethoven, actually.
It's a very interesting point, isn't it? Because already in this very early stage of his life, he was writing these endless, spacious, meditative movements before he went through his big emotional crisis. It's interesting to me that.
Yeah. Though, I mean, if we talk about his handicap, of course, of becoming increasingly deaf, he knew about that remarkably early. I mean, you know, when he was about 20, he probably discovered that this was a problem, and then gradually it developed. So by this time, it has developed into a problem. And so these moments of loneliness, which is so much part of these slow movements, you know, I don't know if it comes from that, but he was alone in the world. That's for sure. And you know, if we turn to the late sonata opus 101, where he was very isolated as a person, at the same time, this is some of the most happy music, you know, I can think of. It has such a spirit of sometimes of inner peace and harmony. You know, also turbulence, but incredible light. And you think, how could this person also find that within him?
The variations in F major, Opus 34, we don't really hear those terribly often.
I think it's a terribly neglected piece, and it's such a wonderful piece. It's a relatively short set of variations, but and like often with, I think, the great composers, when they write great variation pieces, the theme itself is not so remarkable. It's beautiful, yes, but then what they do with it, you know, what Beethoven does with it. I'm just, of course, think about the Diabelli variations, which is like a metamorphosis, you know. But in this piece, just after a very simple F major adagio theme, he turns to D major and a completely different sound world, and like birds singing in the first variation. And from there he goes, you know, there's a march, there's a very lively 6-8 allegro, there is a menuet there, and so many wonderful characters. I just love that piece.
And despite the originality of it, and there are parts of these variations that seem to be looking, particularly the fifth variation, perhaps at a later Beethoven, but despite that, I still think that the contrast in style between that and the next work, chronologically, that you're playing, which is the sonata number 23 in F major, the Appassionata, which is only 3 years later. I mean, it's just a different world straight away, isn't it, in so many ways. Extraordinary.
A different world, but it's also a very different kind of piece. I mean, we're going to from a variation where he shows within a very light sort of idiom what he can do with different characters, and then to a very ambitious new form of sonata. But also, you're right, the way that he also uses then the piano when it comes to the Appassionata is just extraordinary. And I think this piece is so loved also so much because of its of the sheer sounds that he created, how he uses the bass, how he uses the extremes of the keyboard is just remarkable. For me, one of the most magical places for me is actually the beginning of the second movement, because that's... Is it a chorale? Is it a melody? What is it? And it's all down in the lower end of the keyboard. And it's just so haunting, you know. You can't go wrong with it. It's just, there's something about those notes. You play them together, and they sound
totally magical, and they sound like the most beautiful melody you've ever heard. And it's not really a melody; it's a chorale, and it all comes from down somewhere, which is very, very deep. And it, of course, the theme develops through a set of variations in a way, as so often in middle and late period Beethoven, going up the treble and ends up, by the angels.
It is this feeling of, isn't it, almost gratitude for nature or whatever, and that, as you have said, it isn't really melodic, it's harmonic, but the performer brings it to sound melodic because of its extraordinary progressions. And I think this is one of the great things in Beethoven. I mean, I think it's a terrible generalization what I've said, because what's a melody? But Beethoven is sometimes spoken of as not being as melodic, shall we say, as some composers. But I think the way you've described it tells us it's a different concept of melody, isn't it?
And I think, yes, I think you're right. And I think the feeling of something melodious and something singing can come from so many aspects in music. And I can't think of any other composer who knew so well the value of an octave, of a third, of a fifth, you know, how it sounds, especially coming from the bass. And, you know, that is something just extraordinary. So by the sound itself, he creates something sounding so wonderfully melodic. And then, of course, I mean, he could also write beautiful melodies. You know, you think of the last movement of the Ninth Symphony and so on. But they often come that it doesn't start there. It starts with rhythm. It starts with harmony and the sound, I think.
That's the thing, isn't it, what you've just said? It doesn't start there. It's conceived in terms of the harmony, which is where he pushed music forward. So that when we come to the Opus 101, of course, there are some extraordinarily daring harmonies in that. Now, you alluded before, which I was very happy you did, about actually a lot of the brightness and beauty and light in this work. But at the same time, of course, we are now on the cusp, really, of late Beethoven, on the cusp, I would say. And here, even now, after all these years, this work can in places sound very strange and very modern.
Yeah, and it's a very diverse piece of music within itself. I mean, talking about melody just now, I mean, I just think the first movement of this sonata is one of the most beautifully lyrical things that any composer has ever written. And it just sounds like a total unbroken melody for as long as it lasts, what is it, 3 minutes or so. And then you have this march-like movement, which is really only march-like. I mean, it's not really a march, and it's a very quirky march, the second movement, and which makes me always think of Schumann, because I think, you know, Schumann clearly has loved that movement so much, and that all the dotted rhythm stuff going on that you know, you find that in so many Schumann pieces. And then a very dark, slow, very short, slow movement, and the most wonderfully quirky, ingenious movement of all, I think, you know, is the last movement. Very long, contrapuntal, but breaks up into all kinds of dancing rhythms. And here is, I think, this is such happy music. I mean, it's so young at heart in a way, and you know, where he found the energy to feel that, you know, it's unbelievable in his situation.
For the pianists at the time, it must have been an enormously demanding thing to take on a work. And most of these sonatas of Beethoven, but particularly the later ones, where the contrasts are so diverse.
Sure. Yeah.
And that's a big challenge, isn't it?
For us, it's a big challenge. And in our time, when we have been used to so much different and diverse piano repertoire, we can imagine at that time. I mean, I remember as a child, also as a student, I found it very foreign sometimes to play Beethoven's piano music, because you felt that there was often nothing in the middle of the keyboard. There would be things at the extreme of the keyboard, they had at least. If you think of the radical change from a Mozart sonata, where you deal so often with things going on in the middle, it's much more comfortable to play. And then this space that Beethoven tries to create with this melodies very high up in the register and the bass, you know, very enigmatic in a way, but so rich when you start to go into it and find out how to use this for space in the music?
Well, you have, I'm right in saying, I think, already recorded certainly the next of the Beethoven Journey concerto discs. And I think it's coming out as we're recording this. It'll be virtually coming out, your next Beethoven concerto recording on its way.
Which is number 2 and 4. And I'm very excited about that. And then again in May, we're recording already number 5, The Emperor, and The Choral Fantasy. So then we have done all of them.
And the Beethoven journey will continue beyond there as a geographical journey, as a psychological journey, as a musical journey?
Well, for me, a sort of peak season with in this journey with the concertos is then the next season, where I'm doing many residencies in different cities, playing all 5 Beethoven concertos and the Choral Fantasy in 10 or 12 cities around the world. And it will be finished in July 15, and then I think I will say goodbye to the Beethoven concertos for a while at least, because it's been a very, very intense period. When it comes to other pieces like sonatas and so on, I will certainly continue to play them the next years. And this is music that will follow me for the rest of my life, of course.
And this brings us to the end of this podcast. Leif Overeindsnes, thank you enormously for joining me today.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
We will say au revoir to you for now with the last movement, a little extract of Beethoven's 3rd piano concerto, played by you in your Beethoven Journey recording and conducted by you with the Mahler Chamber Orchestra.
Thanks for listening to this archive edition of the Nothing Concrete podcast, here to inspire more people to discover and love the arts, with weekly episodes of archive finds and themed series. Subscribe to Nothing Concrete on Acast, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. And if you can, leave us a review to help us get the word out.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.